Episode Simply Focus mit Elva Czerny and Dominic Gilder for live and joy and
Hi, and welcome to this new episode. Please welcome your hosts, Elfie Czerny and Dominic Godin.
Welcome back, everyone. We are in Wilmington, North Carolina, finally back at the East Coast and sitting here with David Weber from the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. Hello, David.
Hello, Elfie. How are you doing today?
We are doing great. It's such a beautiful weather outside. On the one hand, it's so great to be here with you and with your partner, Marie. And we've been spending 2 days with you and talked about solution focus and teaching and leadership. And it's so great just to be here and spend time with you. We met each other at the Soul Conference way back about 10 years ago, and I remember not only our talks about teaching and using solution focus, but also about you singing songs at the Soul Cabaret.
Right. Well, in my next life, I plan on being a singer, so the Soul Cabaret is a great starting ground for me. Yeah, that was back in 2008 that we met.
Yeah, and Dominic and you also had a lot of conversations around the topic of teaching solution focus in a university setting. And how to be the professor you want to be, how to embrace solution focus in teaching. And we had the honor yesterday to join two of your classes and see you interacting with your students. And you also allowed us to interact with them and to hear what they appreciate about you and your style and way of teaching. And there are so many solution focused aspects in it that we are very much looking forward to talk about that today with you.
Well, I'm looking forward to exploring some of my own thoughts about that with you. Yesterday, I didn't have to do much work. You guys did all the work, and I learned a lot from watching you, so I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Thank you very much. We are looking forward to that, too. You are professor at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington?
Correct.
And you've been in organizational development for a long, long time, and came across solution focus, and that changed not only your way of interacting with organizations, but also your teaching.
Correct.
So to start with, what fascinates you with solution focus?
I was in organizational development as my primary professional involvement for 20 years. And then I went back to school to get a PhD because I thought I could charge more money with a PhD as an organizational development consultant. But I ended up really enjoying the academic world quite a bit. So I thought, well, you know, if I can make a mid-career career change to the academic world, I'd like to do that. So I still do consulting, and I've never really left that. And my teaching specialty is in organizational communication, but I'm not a full-time consultant anymore. I am a full-time academic professional, if you will. And before I got involved in solution focus specifically, I'd always been involved in what I know other people in the SF community have referred to as approaches that have a family resemblance to solution focus. But what I found in solution focus when I got involved in that specifically was I found a moment-to-moment, day-by-day sort of application orientation of these fundamental principles of looking at what's working instead of focusing on what's not working, looking on affirming rather than disconfirming, and employing approaches to facilitating change that were very elegant, streamlined, and straightforward. So I think that's what's the good news about many different approaches, but SF takes it to a very specific level of thought and action, and that's what fascinated me about SF. It accommodated much of what I'd been aware of and much of what I'd done, but it also took it to a very specific level of application.
So it was not only a theoretical part, but also this very active part where you see this bits and parts, how to apply it, and not only talking on this theoretical level.
And then when I got involved in the more formal academic study of communication, it was a perfect marriage, because now I can unpack various processes and organizations in more specific communication-oriented terms, and I can support clients in, I think of it as, making more effective communication choices. Here's something that's possibly controversial or possibly something of a disagreement that some SF practitioners, you know, might disagree with me on this, but personally, I think organizations are only sites of communication. There's no other lexicon, there's no other way of talking about what happens in organizations except by using communication-oriented vocabulary. And I agree that that's something that not everybody will agree with. But because I see the world through the lens of communication, I really take it very literally. So to me, working with SF is working with people to enable them to make more effective communication choices based on the idea of what's going on right now, that you'd like to be different, what's your ideal alternative to that, what strengths do you have, etc. And all of that gets filtered through the filtration paper of communication and communication choices and communication practices.
And how do you help your students to make those choices or to see those choices they have?
I do that in, I think, two ways, maybe three ways. Number one, I like to think that I role model effective communication choices. I don't think I'm a perfect communicator. No one is. But I certainly think that I take communication seriously as a human endeavor to refine, to polish, and to always attempt to improve. And I like to think that my students see me doing that and possibly are inspired to do the same.
We heard a lot from your students yesterday, so it seems they see you doing those things. And it doesn't only seem so, they also shared very, very concrete things like building a yes and setting with your students, like being interested in their perspectives, showing true interest in what they have to say, and then pick up on that and build on that. So there are a lot of things we heard yesterday, very concrete things.
Well, in the class, Elfie, what you're referring to is a moment in class when Dominic asked something along the lines of to my students, so what does David Weber do that you think is effective in interaction? And I assumed that the response would be dead silence, crickets, as we say. But the students were very kind to making some observations about me as a communicator that it really brought a tear to my eye. I was very touched. And then afterward, Alfie, you said that was quite a resource shower. And I said, yes, it was. So the things that they were saying were the kind of things that I'm relieved that they picked up, because they're the kind of things I try to work on. And, you know, I think of it as, you know, always affirming someone. And I dropped the ball on that. I did just today in my lecture, I dropped the ball. I didn't affirm when I absolutely could have. So as we say, no one's perfect, but the students pick up on the fact that I'm in the business of trying to support people rather than in the business of trying to find out what's wrong and, you know, how they can overcome something that's a problem, but rather how can I support you in maintaining strengths and valuing your strengths. I like this phrase I learned years ago, claiming your strengths. So that's one thing I'd like to do, the role modeling. A second thing I do is coaching my students, and I do that in two ways. One is in class. I like to think of a classroom experience as a conversation. So the students are having conversations with each other. They're having conversation with me. I'm facilitating a variety of activities that promote interaction. Even in my large class, 200 students, I still have them doing a lot of interaction. So what happens is that when the students are saying things to each other or saying things to me, I can coach them in refining the choice. So just for example, today in my large lecture class, I gave them an assignment where I wanted them to each think of what's called a research question. And so, you know, a couple of students would put forth their research question. And I'd say, well, that works really well. Here's one way to possibly adjust that. And I'd say, so why don't you put that in your own words, you know? I say things differently from the way you say things differently from the way, how would you say that question in your own words? So I think of that as coaching, and it starts from affirming, well, that's a good starting point, that really works, you know, let's just polish it a little bit. And then the other aspect of coaching is students come see me in my office and they'll say something along the lines of, you know, I want to find out what I did wrong on the exam. And I'll show them the exam and we'll talk about the exam from the point of view of, well, what did you do right? You know, a student will say, I got a D on the exam. I'll say, well, you know, thank heaven you didn't get an F. I mean, I'd be really worried if you got an F. How did you get a D? You know, and they'll say, well, I didn't study. I said, well, you had to do something to get a D, you know, and they'll say, well, I guess I guessed right. I said, well, that's good. So that's, you know, guessing well, that's something that you don't want to downplay that. That's important, you know. You don't want to rely on it 100% in life, but at least it's something to rely on. What else did you do right? Well, I remembered such and such. So I get them talking about that. And then I'll say, well, so what can we do in the future to take advantage of that and maybe add to that skill set? And so that's coaching in the office. And I think that plus the role model. And then the third thing would really be telling stories, telling narratives of other people and their experience of thinking and solutions solutions-focused way. I can draw from my own experience of my own life. I can draw from client experiences. I can talk about experiences that, for example, that I heard Dominique or Elfie that maybe you shared with me about your clients. And I can illustrate in the course of a lecture or discussion, I can illustrate with anecdotes how this actually works in real life. You know, stories from the various SF books, or just even not making up a story, but taking something that wasn't SF, but telling the story from the point of view of solution focus. Here's an example of the latter. There's an old baseball story about a baseball player, a great baseball player named Ted Williams, who was famous for being very informal, never wore a tie. So one day, the manager of his team retired and they hired a new manager from another team. And this new manager was famous for being a stickler for attire. And he and Ted Williams had a meeting and all these sports reporters were outside the office expecting that the two were going to maybe get into a fight or something like that. Well, Williams and the new manager walked out arm in arm laughing, and Williams went his way and the reporters stuck around and said to the manager, whose name was Joe McCarthy, they said, "Joe, how did you do that with Ted Williams?" And McCarthy said, "Well," he said, "a baseball player as good as Ted Williams, you kind of let him do what he wants to do a little bit." Well, that suddenly becomes a solution-focused story. It's like, what was Ted Williams' strength? How can I support his strength in order for him to contribute to the team? And, you know, when I heard that story, it had nothing to do with solution focus. The person who told me that story years ago was not a solution-focused consultant. But hearing the story, I thought, well, that can be framed. So that's what I mean by telling stories.
And years ago, you had this wonderful example on the soul list. We were writing back and forth about how to use solution focus in the classroom. And then you wrote this beautiful example of someone who wanted to have a better grade and came into your office and you coached this person. So what did you exactly do there, and how did that experience shape things you did in the future?
I remember the conversation. I remember the post. And again, many of these examples come from the large lecture class. And I have to give you just a tiny bit of background. The large lecture class is 200 students. They must pass the class with a grade of B or better, which is pretty high, or they don't get to major in communication. They have to do something else. So the stakes are high for every student. So in that class, more than any other class I teach, students who don't earn a B are always coming in to see if they can get a B. And historically, what they do is they'll come in and they'll say, "Can I do some extra credit to get a few more points to get a B?" Or, you know, "Can't you just give me a B? You know, I really, really, really love communication studies," and all that stuff. So I always tell them, I'm open-minded to some discussion and negotiation. I'm open-minded. First of all, I'll say, make an argument in support of the claim you, Weber, should raise my grade. Make an argument. You know how to write an argument. That's a strength. Take advantage of that strength. Write me an argument. So they do that, and then they'll come and they'll present it orally, because I say, present the argument orally. So they'll do that. And then, you know, we'll go through a whole thing. And if it's a good argument, you know, I'll grant the higher grade. But I think the part that Dominique was remembering especially is I make them a deal. And I say, okay, now I'm making an investment in you. And not only that, I'm making an investment on behalf of my other faculty colleagues in you. By giving you a higher grade, we're moving you on through the major. That doesn't come for free. What I want you to do is meet me in the middle, meet me halfway. And for the next semester, for the first 8 weeks of the semester, I want you to come in for coaching once a week, 15, 20 minutes. And we're going to be talking about what you're doing that's working, how you can do more of it. So the students agree to do that. They do it for the first half of the semester. It's, shall we say, classic SF interaction once they're in the coaching event for 15, 20 minutes. I often do give them what I call a homework assignment. And I know that's not technically part of the SF tradition, but I like to have them do or think about doing or think about thinking about doing something so that when they come back for the next coaching session, at least we have something to spin off of. And if they don't do the assignment, I don't get wrapped around the axle. I just say, well, what's better? So that's more in the classic SF approach to coaching. They love it. They really do, if I can be so bold. The reason I say that is I tell them, you can stop after 8 weeks. After 8 weeks, I'll get a sense of whether my investment paid off. And if you want to continue, we can. But if you don't, we don't. But at least give me 8 weeks. And they often, almost always, will do the rest of the semester because they like having someone they can talk to and they know I'm supportive. I think it helps them move through that whole process of getting serious about the major. I think that's the post I was talking about. That was kind of my original way of doing this. And then one semester, I can't remember how I thought of it, it dawned on me that I wanted to start having them be much more focused on the idea of bringing something to a team, because these students do a lot of teamwork. Some of them are more effective than others in how they function on a team. So I really wanted to actually kind of reinforce that idea of working with others. So I started asking them questions about how they're doing in a particular class that they always take after mine, in which teamwork, team assignments are absolutely central. So I'll ask them things like, well, how are you contributing to the team? What's the best thing you did this week with respect to service to your team? How did you step up into a leadership role this week? Oh, you didn't. Well, let's try that for next week. What do you think you'd bring to the table if you were a leader next week? And that kind of questioning. I think they really appreciate that, because one of the classic problems we have in the department, if I can talk about a problem, one of the things is the students aren't really necessarily good at team stuff. And I think that it's to everybody's advantage for them to develop those kind of skills. So this is an opportunity, kind of the coaching is not just this sheer personal development, but it's personal development plus specifically skill development and team functioning.
And what I also hear listening to those questions is to show that each and every student has an impact. Mm-hmm. So for me, it also comes back to mm-hmm. personal development, to be mm-hmm. aware of the impact I have and how I can create this impact and co-create it with others.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting you say that, because one of the concepts I brought to the department, I only started teaching this large introductory class in, I think it was 2009. And one of the concepts that I wanted to bring to the class when I taught it was new for everybody in the department. It's not an unknown concept, but it was new to just about everybody. And that's the concept of Tikkun Olam, which is a Talmudic expression that means contributing to the repair of the world. And Tikkun Olam has been actually somewhat changed from its original religious or spiritual origin. It existed as a concept in the intersection of legality, spiritualism, relationships between men and women. But it's been kind of changed over the years to become a general concept of, you know, be a giver rather than a taker in life. And I like that concept very much. So I will say to the students on day one of the intro class, you know, part of why you'd want to study communications to be more effective in the endeavor of Tikkun Olam. So now everybody who goes through the program kind of knows that concept, and I can kind of hook into it and I can rely on it. And this gets back to what you were saying, Elfie. Personal development gets defined in terms of your ability and willingness to contribute to the repair of the world. And how you do that is a function of the communication choices you make or don't make. So I think there's this really fairly coherent, congruent set of principles that sort of come together that afford a person development personally and afford a person the opportunity to become a better student, to become more effective in his or her life. This is something many departments don't do. Many university departments, the professors think of themselves as subject matter experts. And we think of ourselves, my department, as character developers.
And your students also go out into the real world and mm-hmm. do things with that. You just yesterday mentioned this wonderful example with the miracle question
mm-hmm.
and
right.
the difference this made. So how did this come about?
Okay, that's one of my favorite examples of how some of this works. So I teach a course called Communication Consulting, which is essentially solution-focused consulting. And then we learn the term solution-focused and so forth. Well, what happens is that a given student may not necessarily install in his or her memory and muscle memory the entire SF system. But they often will remember parts of it. And I think, you know, many years ago, a dentist said to me, if you don't floss every day, it's not a terrible thing. Floss as often as you can. Try to be intentional about it. But, you know, don't get too, you know, messed up if you don't floss every single day. Well, that's what I tell the students. I say, look, if you don't remember every single step of the SF approach to organizational change, if you remember some of it, that's at least a start. So the students will take that into, say, their internship. So the story I think that you were referring to was a student told me, this is only within the last year, she said, I was in a meeting with my internship and we got really stuck on this one particular issue in the meeting. We couldn't kind of break beyond it. And she said, suddenly I remembered the miracle question. So she said, you know, in front of everybody in the meeting, she said, okay, I think I have a way of maybe handling this. She said, I want everybody to imagine that we go home, we finish the meeting, go home, have dinner, go to sleep. And overnight, unbeknownst to any of us, a miracle occurs, you know, the miracle question. And after the meeting, the head of the company came up to her and said, that was a great question. That really popped for us. That got us thinking. That was really cool. So that's what I mean by, you know, if you can't remember all of it, students, remember some of it and use some of it. Mm-hmm.
And you also mentioned how you teach the miracle question, or kind of how you frame solution-focused mm-hmm. questions and how you prepare kind of your conversation partners to mm-hmm. also go along with that.
Well, I think what you're referring to there is one of the things I like to do with SF, and I'm not a developer of SF approaches. I've never written an SF book or anything like that. You know, Dominique, you've done everything from the cards to that wonderful leadership research project, and I've never really done that kind of thing. But what I do like to do is try to think about how do you get clients to buy into some of the questions you ask and approaches that you propose. I always enjoy figuring out little sort of conversational moves to make, is what I think of them as. So when I teach the miracle question to my students, I don't teach them, I don't say, okay, here's the miracle question, ask it. I'll say, here's how you can ask that question so that people won't get backed up by the idea of, I don't believe in miracles or whatever. Instead of just saying, okay, imagine this, I'll say, here's how you do it. So you're my client. I say to you, I'd like you to imagine something. Do you use your imagination at work? Person's almost always going to say, yeah. I say, oh, man, you're going to love this. And that sets up this openness to the miracle question. I mean, in my life as a consultant, when that was the full-time thing I did, I worked a great deal with engineers and all that sort of thing. So I know there's people you run into who, the idea of a miracle is just not going to fly. But I think if you start to think about what do they have to buy into? Well, most people are going to buy into the proposal that they have imagination. Or if you ask them, are you imaginative? Do you work with your imagination? Almost everybody's going to say, yeah. And then you just say, God, this is going to be great for you. You'll like this. And you're presupposing they're going to get into it. And then you ask these tough questions.
That's wonderful. And it just reminds me of this wonderful question of a colleague of ours who participated a solution-focused leadership course with us and mm-hmm. then started to ask the miracle question. And what he did was his employee was about to go on holiday.
Mm-hmm.
So he used the holiday, and he didn't say, when you wake up tomorrow, but when you come back after your holiday.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
And that made such a difference for the employee, because it was like really in his life and in his frame and in his experience. And 2 weeks of holiday, a lot of things can happen, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So when you shared your story, this just came to my mind when it comes also to imagination. Not only ask for imagination, but also use your own imagination.
Right.
What could be the most helpful thing for the person you're talking and how you can utilize what's there.
Well, I think one of the big expansions for me of my relationship to SF was getting to a certain point where I felt comfortable enough to kind of create my own style in using it. And I believe I'm always faithful to the fundamental principles. And I think, the journal interaction in the back of each issue has a list of kind of these are SF principles. I use that as a true north. And I don't believe I violate any of those, or if I do, it's only occasionally and unintentionally. Even with a commitment to a certain ethos, you still have a lot of elbow room if you have a creative mind, if you're curious, if you have a sort of a willingness to play and experiment. I like doing that. And it took me a while to get to that point. But once I got to that point, I think I became more effective in my use of SF approaches. You have to start somewhere. You have to start with, how to do the basics. But then I think it's important that as practitioners, we give ourselves at least some permission to play and to experiment.
And what helped you to get to this point?
I think what helped me was, I hate to say it because it's so prosaic, but simply getting older. I got to a certain stage in my own life course where I said, I have a certain amount of wisdom. I'm not inconsequential as a human being. I have worth and value as a human being. And once I started saying that, then I started to give myself this permission. And also, not so prosaically, also, confidence and a little bit of skill. When I first started really being attentive to using SF, I wasn't as effective as I think I am now. And believe me, I still have much further to go. I don't think anybody's perfect. I certainly don't think I'm even close to that. But I do have a certain baseline confidence. And I think that's how I got to that point.
This also brings me, and here's a little assumption of mine, but to your experience of traveling the world and mm-hmm. living in different countries. You mentioned you lived in Iran, lived in Japan for a while,
mm-hmm.
and you traveled a lot of different places in mm-hmm. the world, not only for a 2 days holiday, but really staying there for a month and immersing yourself in the culture. So what differences do those experiences make for your solution-focused work?
Let's see. I haven't thought about that before. I do have a pretty extensive background in international travel and living, not as much as some. And I mean, again, I'm not trying to set myself up as some kind of international adventurer exactly. But I do think I have a certain awareness of the world that I wouldn't have got had I not traveled and lived overseas. And I think that that has given me a certain, it's hard to put it into words exactly, but here's a little bit of a story. After doing a great deal of international living and traveling and so forth, I noticed that when I would travel in the United States, I was experiencing the new places I'd see as if they were an international destination. I would go to New York City, and suddenly it wasn't, okay, I'm an American tourist in New York City, but I'm a person who's in this environment that is essentially as different to me as any international environment is. I started to experience the world in many ways that was new to me, as if it was as new as an international destination is. And I think the point here is that seeing myself navigate those kind of new environments, every time I do that, I always get more confident. A couple of years ago, I went to Poland, and I almost didn't because I thought, oh, it's going to be really hard to travel there. I don't want to drive. You know, I like going by train, getting by train. Oh, maybe I won't go to Poland. And then I thought to myself, you know, man up, go to Poland. Nobody thinks this is funny, but to me, it's kind of a catchphrase. You know, I'll say, the worst that happens is I hate it. You know, as opposed to the worst that happens is I'll be kidnapped or something. Yeah. But no, the worst that happens is I don't have a good time. And so I went to Poland. And again, that's not a great big deal. And, you know, I'm not trying to say anything bad about Poland. I loved it there. But I'm just saying that I thought of it as this overwhelmingly impossible to navigate world, and it wasn't. Well, so it is with SF interactions and working with clients. Sometimes we can get a little bit intimidated by the challenge, and if you have a background of more or less frequently with some level of effectiveness, navigating the new, navigating the different, I think that you can bring that kind of confidence to your navigation of these relationships and client interactions and organizational situations that may be otherwise very challenging.
I love that. And I also hear the curiosity. So becoming curious for the obvious things, or becoming curious for the things like in the example of New York. And I guess you have been traveling to New York quite often. So
over the years, yeah.
Yeah. So seeing something, not as an American tourist being in New York, but as David Weber being at this place at this time in this moment and experience it in a different way. I think this is a very solution-focused thing to do.
Yeah. There, you know, there's another thing I think it's a very solution-focused thing to do. I don't hear this spoken of that often one way or the other. But, you know, in American culture, there's an expression, can do, C-A-N-D-O, can do. That's just an American cultural thing, and I don't know where it came from, but, you know, can do. And, you know, in America, we talk about the can-do spirit and this kind of stuff. Well, I buy into that, you know? I mean, to me, that's a very solution-focused way of thinking. It's like I'm going to encounter such and such a situation. Hey, can do. I can think of clients that I've worked with and I've felt very challenged, and I'm thinking, how am I going to work with them? But then I'll think, hey, you know, can do. I'm the can do guy, the can do spirit. And that, you know, that kind of brings out something good in me, something effective in me. At least I think it does. But, you know, I don't think I would have thought that way if I hadn't been immersed in SF. It's taking that idea of, you know, we can work this out. Taking that idea very seriously, not just as a catchphrase, but as a way of thinking and being and feeling. I don't know if I would have got there without SF. That's how I kind of get through a lot of these things.
And with traveling, you also notice that people are different everywhere and that they're experts for their lives and mostly have no clue how their life works. And
yeah,
especially as a professor, as a teacher, this is such a valuable mindset to have to also see your students as experts. Well, mostly as teachers, we learn that we are the experts and that students are learners.
Yep.
And when we saw you working, when we heard your students, they told us that you see them as experts. And so how do you exactly do that?
Yeah, that's a very good point. That actually was when they said words along those lines, that was very moving to me. I think I remember years ago, I was on an airplane with a friend of mine named Jim, and both of us were consultants who had gone back to school to get a PhD in our 40s. We were both in the same program. And we'd known each other before that too. So we were on an airplane flying somewhere. And Jim said, he said two things on that flight that have really been pivotal pivotal in my professional development as a professor and also as a consultant trainer. He said, learning does not occur outside of the context of relationship. I mean, I think that's really true. You know, the quality of your experience of learning is the quality of your experience of the building and maintenance of relationships with the others that you're learning with. And, you know, that could be disagreed with. I mean, I know of people who are self-taught because they read books and so forth. Well, actually, that's a relationship. It's a relationship with the author. It's what we would call an asynchronous relationship. It's not a real-time relationship, but it's a relational simulacrum. So learning doesn't occur outside of the context of relationship. And he also said, when in doubt, turn it over to the students. And I think that's so true. So part of this is, you know, when I look at them as experts, I never thought of that phrase, but I look at them as solution searchers when a solution needs to be found. Just yesterday, the class that both of you were talking about, two students came up to me and I had given them a proposal the previous class meeting. I said, I'd like you guys to think about doing such and such. And they came up after class and they said, we were really thinking about it. And I'd said, we don't have to make a decision today, but let's talk about it Wednesday. So they came up after class and they said, you know, we thought about what you proposed and we're not sure we want to do it, but, you know, here's one thing we could do instead. And I said, man, that's great. I didn't even think of that. And it's going to get me and them and the class to the same point that I wanted to get them to when I made my original proposal. It's going to get us to exactly the same destination. So why not let them map it out? And one of my colleagues has a funny, I think it's a funny expression for this. He used to be, when he was in college, he worked in a men's store. And he said, if the man wants a blue suit, turn on the blue light. Meaning, you know, I have a place where I want my students to go as a professor. And I may think I know the best way to get there, but sometimes they know a better way to get there. And I want to be open-minded to let them, because, you know, if they say, this is how we think we can get to this place, the chances are really good that they're going to be totally engaged with and committed to getting to that point. Whereas if they only have my option as the only option, they may not get there. And what does that do to the learning experience?
And you have a lot of relationship to them.
Oh, yeah.
By co-creating it with them together,
it's a co-creation.
Inviting them and, well, walking the talk.
Yeah, they really responded well. You brought up that term co-creation yesterday, and both of you were talking about co-creation with my students. And I could tell they really responded well to that concept. And I use the word co-construction, but that may be a little bit too technical. I think co-creation was freeing in many ways, and they liked it. And I will bet that after Easter break, I'm going to be hearing a lot about co-creation.
We are curious to hear more about that.
Yeah.
What
yeah.
do you encounter when you come back after Easter break, and maybe after the miracle happening, or some miracles happening in this 1 week?
David, we talked about a lot of things you do in your classroom differently, and I'm still very curious to look at the beginning of this journey. How did you start, and what, you know, were your first steps that gave you the confidence of keep going, and how did you do that?
Well, you know, it's funny. I've been actually teaching for a long, long time, and my first formal training as a teacher was in elementary school teaching, and I was not good. I didn't have any confidence. I was not good at managing behavior in an elementary school classroom, and if you can't manage behavior, forget it. You're not going to be very effective. So I moved out of that. That's when I moved into the business world and started getting into organizational development and so forth. But my journey has been so many mistakes early on, so many mistakes. I look back at stuff I did or didn't do with clients in the past, for example. I think, God, if I could only rewind the tapes and redo that, you know, that intervention. Same thing with college teaching. I've been now full-time college teaching for 20 years. But when I first started out, just a tiny little example is I remember saying on day one in one class, I said, you know, my background is organizational development and training. I'm going to be treating you guys like managers, you know, and I thought this was like a, you know, compliment. It wasn't. They hated it. It's like, we are who we are. Treat us like who we are. And so what I think happened was, and again, solution focus came to the rescue here, if you will. I noticed that in the early years of my involvement with SF, I noticed that it was like I would turn it on and turn it off. So I would maybe do a training that was, you know, I would bring to bear some of my SF learnings. But in the university classroom, I did not. And I thought to myself, this is really crazy. If I really take this stuff seriously, I need to integrate it absolutely into my life. So I started doing things like on day one of a course, I would say, you know what this course is about. You read the description in the course catalog. What do you think about that? Where are you with this? And then, you know, break into teams of three, discussing it. And then I'd say, well, so now what's an alternative to that? If you could wake up in a miracle, you know, the miracle question, to get them to talk about course goals. And then I'd have them talk about strengths that they could use. So suddenly the flow of what happened in the classroom essentially was borrowed from the flow of what happens in a coaching session. And that was liberating for, I think, everybody. And when I saw that happen for the first time, I thought, oh my gosh, this is good. And that, just seeing a little bit of a success story, that sort of enabled me to start playing with this a little bit more. And again, you know, the older I got, the more confident I got. I'm over 60. And when I hit 60, that was a liberating birthday for me. I said, you know, I think I'm 60. I think I'm going to start to give myself a little credit for being, like, you know, somewhat accomplished as a humanoid life form.
And you still don't look like 60. And I know I keep on saying that for several people, but I think one of the things, and this is one of the things you mentioned here, to really immerse yourself fully into solution focus or embrace it in every part of your life. And I feel people doing that usually look much younger than they are in their physical body life. So, David, what differences does solution focus make in your everyday life?
To me, that's kind of like an ultimate question. It makes a massive difference in the sense that it perfectly fits. It gives me a vocabulary that I didn't have it before, but I was looking for a way to kind of be more operationally effective in bringing this particular belief I'll share into action. So the belief is this. Years ago, I had just left elementary school. I was in the beginnings of my career in organizational work, and I read an article in the LA Times about how teachers from the LA school district were being sent around to schools across town and this kind of thing. So you'd have a teacher in an African-American community who'd be taken from that community, put into a white suburban school, and vice versa. So the article was about three teachers who this is happening with. And one of the teachers was an African-American teacher who was sent to a white suburban school, and he was bitter and angry. And he said, I've only got 5 more years and then I'm retiring and I'm done. And another teacher was a white teacher who was put into a school in the African-American community, and she was going to sue the school, and she was bitter and angry. And the third teacher was a white woman who was in an African-American community school. And when she was interviewed for the article, all the kids were running around and hugging her, you know, all these little kids that, you know, they were African-American, Hispanic, they were non-white. Here she was, this classic white suburban gal. And they were hugging her and laughing with her. And the reporter said, you know, everybody else I've interviewed for this story is like really hating life. And she said, well, I was kind of indignant at first myself, but she said, I'm the type of person who doesn't say, why is this happening to me, but what can I learn from this experience? And I read that. And I said, my gosh, what a way to live. And SF ties into that. Not why is this happening to me, but what can I learn from this? I mean, that's an SF question. And, you know, what's happening now that I would rather be different? What are the alternatives that are more desirable? What are the strengths I have, et cetera? That I think of it as a 4-step template that you just ask. You know, I was traveling in Israel in December, and I went to this bus station, and it was like there was no information about the bus I was looking for. I don't happen to read Hebrew, so I couldn't read the signs. There was no English. But I thought, you know, not, oh, God. Why is this happening to me? I thought, well, what can I learn from this experience? And I thought, well, what's my idea? My ideal is that, and I just walked through it. And it's amazing how natural that has become as just a way of life. And if that has yielded, you know, a smaller number of wrinkles, I'm very happy about that.
Well, I love to hear that. And it reminds me of what Dominique and I are doing in situations like that. We usually say, wow, that's a cool story.
Yeah,
let's
yeah.
see how we want to tell this story in a few weeks.
And
then joy comes and a lot of ideas and possibilities.
Right.
So on your journey, on your solution-focused journey, what is one learning that was particularly important for you and also might make a difference for others out there?
You know, I would like to reserve the privilege of changing my mind about this as the answer to the question in the future, but it comes to mind. It's a story that occurred at an SF conference, the one in Romania, Bucharest, which was 2010. So I woke up one morning, it was like, I think the last morning at that conference, and this may bring a tear to my eye. I woke up the last morning of the conference, and I had no voice. I literally could not make noise with my voice. And I realized, oh shoot, I'd stayed outside the night before having some, I forget the name of the drink, but it's like a Romanian moonshine. And we were sitting around talking and laughing and stuff. And I was outside without a jack. I just kind of chilled. My voice went completely. And I remember thinking to myself, again, not why is this happening to me, but what can I learn from this experience? I thought, now, how exactly exactly would I have done something differently? To make a long story short, I realized that I hadn't shared with a number of people at the conference, and I can remember the people. I hadn't shared with them how much they meant to me and how much I really liked them. And you had gone, so you were one, but you'd gone already. But there are a few people still around. And I remember coming out to breakfast, and there were people sitting around there, and several of them were people I wanted to say. And I squeaked out, you know, I really appreciate you. And, you know, we would hug and we would laugh, and my voice started to come back. And I think that the SF community provides, at least it has provided for me, this studio for being a real human being. And I think that when you start to move outside of that, the challenge is, are you going to still be that real human being that you had support in practicing being when you were in the SF embrace in the conference or wherever it is? I don't know if that answers the question, but that story came to mind when you asked it.
And I remember it was the only conference that had restaurants where they served bear meat.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, I don't think I ate the bear, but I remember we went to a restaurant, they served bear.
Yeah. I don't eat meat.
Well, you're
at all,
vegetarian, so right? Yeah, vegetarians don't eat bears.
I mean, the yuck is what Bibi would say.
Yeah.
So let's come to the vegetarian challenge of the week.
Well, let's go back to actually something I said. I'd like to revisit that question that I attributed to that teacher in Los Angeles. What can I learn from this experience? The challenge would be, when you're in whatever the situation is, not necessarily go to a traditional SF formula, but say, okay, not why is this happening to me, but what can I learn from this experience? What can I learn from this experience of being stuck in traffic? What can I learn from this experience of, you know, being thrown off of my flight because the flight was canceled? What can I learn from this experience of feeling like I don't know what to do with this client right now? What can I learn from this experience? I think that would be the challenge, is have the experience of walking yourself through that thought process at least once in the upcoming week.
Thank you very much.
So what can we learn from this podcast? What inspired you? Let us know. Share with us what you took away from conversation we have with David, and share that in our comments field of this podcast. Go to www.sfontour.com/simplyfocuspodcast and then go to this podcast.
Once again, a big thank you, David, for having us here, inviting us into your lives here in Wilmington.
It's been such a pleasure. I really appreciate getting a chance to know you, Elfie, specifically. Specifically, Dominique, I've met before. You know, we hadn't met before. I felt an instant connection with you when we met. I mean, I really think that there's some way in which we vibrate to the same frequency in many respects. And I've always had a great deal of affection and respect for Dominique, all the work he's done in SF. And I'm just really delighted to have this opportunity to get closer to you, too.
This is totally likewise, David. So thank you very much.
Yes, thank you very much. And we could sing a song at the next Soul Conference at the Soul Cabaret together.
We could make it a trio.
Can't wait for it. So the next Soul Conference will be in Budapest on May 23rd to May 26th.
That's
you
right.
Will find everything in the resource section of our podcast.
So thank you again. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And have a great week. And goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Thank you.
You're listening to the Simply Focus podcast with Elfie Czerny and Dominic Godat, your podcast for a life in joy and ease.